I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, how's it going? Welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week, we're chatting to Nigel Farndale. He's a journalist, an award-winning interviewer, and his new book is The Dictator's Muse. It's set in 1930s Europe. It's all about a filmmaker, an athlete, and a Welsh communist, and how their lives entwine as Hitler's grip tightens. We talk about the difference between writing novels and articles, how he goes about writing real-life people in fictional stories as well, and we discuss how sometimes the thing that he's writing just manages to sort itself out if you give it time.
I had to go somewhere in a car, if there's a car journey, it might have been a school run. And that meant having not being able to take your hands off a steering wheel and make sort of notes. It forced you to sort of think through the structure of the whole column idea in your head. So when you got to the end of the journey and got hold of a laptop, it was almost like downloading it fully formed.
There's more on the way with Nigel Farndale in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along. My name's Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine. It's the show where we have a look inside the day of some of the best authors around. This week, it's Nigel Farndale. He's an award-winning journalist. He won a British Press Award for his interviews. He's interviewed Paul McCartney, Prince Charles, Hillary Clinton, the Dalai Lama, Henry Kissinger, Donald Trump. What a time that must have been. And many others. I think it's important to flag that because speaking to a lot of people gives you a sense of what other people's lives are like. It's the classic, you know, walking a mile in other people's shoes, isn't it? And I wonder how much that helps him get to grips on the characters that he writes for his stories. He's written novels and biographies, articles for The Observer, The Sunday Times, The FT, many more. His last book, The Blasphemer, was shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards back in 2010. His new book is The Dictator's Muse. It's set in 1930s Europe as Hitler's grip tightens and preparations are being made for the Berlin Olympics. It's all about a filmmaker, an athlete, a Welsh communist, and how their lives entangle as the Nazis try to take over. We chat about the paraphernalia of his writing room and how that changes between stories. Also, why he believes that amateurs wait for inspiration and professionals get on with it. Also, why he doesn't think that he's been good at finding the balance between novels and journalism. And there's some unreliable narrator chat in there as well, which is always good fun. Now, while you're listening, if you learn anything along the way that helps the way that you tell your stories, if there's a little bit of advice that you think, I'm gonna do that myself. I'm gonna try and carry that over. Do us a favor, just leave us a little review on Apple. It really goes a long way. And make sure you're following us wherever you get your podcasts too. And it's time to crack on. We start as we always do with what Nigel Farndale sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Well, today I'm looking out at some rather splendid rhododendrons that have just come out. So I do have a view as such, which is can be a mixed blessing. There's some writers, I know Julian Barnes, I once interviewed him and was rather struck by his routine in that he would have to be facing a blank wall. Couldn't even have a picture on it. But that seems a little perverse to me. I used to live in London, and my view was of rooftops in Clapham. And I thought that a little perverse, especially as I was a journalist, mostly working from home as well as writing books. So I thought, let's move to the country. So the country is where I am, in Hampshire, on the Hampshire-Sussex border. And I do look out across a garden, which, as I say, has rhododendrons out in bloom at the moment. And the sun is shining, and it's all nice and distracting.
Take us inside the room. What would I see around me if I were to walk in? What is there that's inspiring? Perhaps something a bit practical? Just run us through that.
Well, there's lots of books. It's one of those, it's a proper study, I suppose, with shelves and shelves of books. A few stat CDs, which are now antiquated. They're gathering dust, haven't been used for a long time. There's a couple of models of there's a Spitfire and a Lancaster bomber, which are sort of beautiful wooden constructions, which I painted black so as they look like silhouettes, and they sit on my chimney piece in the study. There's a log burner. There's a telescope, which is covered in dust, doesn't get used, but I had aspirations to use it at some point, and a few photographs of family. That's about the strength of it.
In the middle of writing a novel, if I were to walk in, would I have any clue as to the story that you're telling? Does the paraphernalia around you change from book to book?
That's funny. There's one I wrote, and I still have a bit of the paraphernalia for it, which called Blasphemer, which featured a Galapagos turtle, and I had a little model of one, which I picked up somewhere. I don't even remember where, but it sort of sat on the desk like a talisman, and I kept sort of looking at it and patting it, and it sort of stayed around here. And yes, so there are odd things, actually. I'm just looking around again. Actually, for the latest one, I do have... a little poster for a film that was directed by and starred Leni Riefenstahl, who's the subject of, or partly the subject of, my new novel. And I saw it on eBay, and it was from produced in 1933, and it's from a cinema in London, and it's just an advert, really. But I just thought that's quite a sort of little curiosity, and I bought it for about 30 quid, and it sort of, that slightly features in the novel, or at least there is a sort of, one of the characters has this sort of poster, and it just sort of gave me a sort of feeling of connection with the story and the atmosphere a bit. So I do like to look at that occasionally.
You mentioned your desk. What forms of, like, the practicalities of writing are there? I'm talking notebooks, a big screen, a little laptop. Just let me get into that space.
So I've got two big screens on my desk. It's one of these sit standing desks, which I just find it quite conducive. I think I was probably. I read somewhere that Hemingway always used to write standing up, and rather pretentiously, I thought I should try this, see if it changes the way you write. And it sort of does. You're more sort of physically engaged somehow in the activity of writing, where rather than slumping in a chair, you're sort of physically engaged. So the desk does that, and it's got a laptop on it, which is a MacBook Pro, which is connected to two screens, which, because I sort of juggle writing books with being a journalist, so my day job is I'm a senior editor on The Times, and have for the past year been working remotely using You can get a sort of through Amazon Workspaces, you can get a sort of a a second screen that's just like the office screen. So I have two screens set up and alternate between them. And in terms of notebooks, I've always kept had scraps of paper from when I sort of first thought of becoming a writer. I was actually a farmer in an earlier incarnation, in that my father was a farmer, my grandfather before him, and I spent a couple of years working on the farm and would always be sort of daydreaming slightly, and sometimes that meant crashing things if I was happened to be daydreaming while driving a tractor with heavy machinery. But I was always have these, I'd tear up little bits of, say if you were feeding cattle from these, feed from these paper bags, I'd tear off little corners of these paper bags and scribble little notes on them, just little phrases or whatever, observations. And at that stage, wasn't really sure why I was doing it. It was just a sort of compulsion. And I've always sort of carried on doing that. So my pockets are always full of torn up little bits of notepaper, but not really anything as organised as a notebook.
Without a cow to feed.
Without a cow to feed, yeah, exactly. Yeah, still going around the sort of fields in a disconsolate way looking for cows to feed.
Now we'll get to the routine and the more specifics of your day in just a sec. I'm just curious about the stand-up writing. How much do you find that affects the length of time that you can spend actually stood there typing away? I would have thought that it might be a bit of a pain on the posture.
Yeah, it does a bit. It's sort of an hour up, an hour down is sort of roughly the ratio. And sometimes when you get intense or you really have to concentrate, then I do tend to sit down. Or it depends whether I'm sort of combining things. I mean, I feel slightly sort of fraudulent in talking about this as a sort of, because it's two separate identities really. So for the writing novels, that is much more trying to shut yourself off and trying to avoid phone calls and distractions on the internet or whatever. I mean, I know some people have those time things on the internet, don't they, to stop you to have a sort of concentrated workspace of several hours where you're not going to be tempted to check on something. But that can be a bit frustrating. So, not being able to check on something as you're writing it. And we've now all got into the habit of, I remember Ian McEwan talking about how the digital age has affected all professions, but for writers, you would actually, when you're doing research, spend a lot of time in libraries and you just don't need to do that anymore because pretty much, not all research is reliable on the internet. Obviously, Wikipedia is a bit of a wild west of anyone can contribute, but there's lots of other good, well-sourced places out there. In fact, you get pretty much the whole of the British Library on the internet, and it's all a sort of few clicks away. So that completely changes the way you sort of access information and possibly speeds up the writing process. But then there's also the sort of business of getting out into the world. That I think writers used to find libraries useful in that respect. Just the business of walking somewhere and having time to think was conducive to writing.
You mentioned just a second ago the kind of difference between writing as a journalist and writing novels. In the initial stages when you began doing that, when you had been a journalist for a while and then started to publish your own books, how long did it take you to figure out that perhaps the way you worked on both, although still writing, it would be slightly different?
I always wanted to be an author. So the journalism was sort of, until you got there, it seemed like a next best thing. But as it turned out, there's always been, in my case, a strong cross-fertilization with ideas and just generally being sort of, because journalism puts you out into the world, and particularly the kind I was doing was a lot of feature writing. You know, it took me to all sorts of interesting places. For instance, I was once sent an assignment to Cairo to interview the Egypt's most famous belly dancer, who had been accosted by Islamic fundamentalists who were threatening to chop her into 1,000 pieces, and she was sort of in hiding. So I sort of tracked her down and sort of talked about her experience, but just spending time in unusual places. And for writers, you know, that always sort of, you know, you're pulling in your sort of environment. And I've spent a lot of time traveling and for feature writing, places like Venezuela and all across America and India and everywhere, really. And it's never wasted time and experience, really. It always sort of seems to crop up somewhere or other in fiction writing. But in terms of, you asked about what it's like when you, was there a moment where you sort of change in the two disciplines? And I think what journalism trains you to do is not wait to be in the right mood to get writing. You have to get on with it because you've got deadlines and usually a very unforgiving commissioning editor who's chomping at the bit. So you don't, it teaches you, you know, there's that saying, amateurs wait for inspirations, whereas professionals get on with it. And that's sort of the difference. There's no sort of, here's a good example. Max Hastings, the famous ex-editor of the Daily Telegraph, is also a very successful historical biographer, writer of history books. And he always used to start his working day at 5 in the morning and would have sort of done a full day's writing before getting into the office for a very demanding day job, which was editing the Daily Telegraph, at about sort of 8:39. So he'd done those really concentrated hours. And that's when he wrote all these incredibly substantial history books. And it's a good sort of, just some people have that sort of energy, I think. And he's an inspirational figure in that respect. I mean, it doesn't suit everyone, but I certainly think treating mornings as being a sort of much more vital and energetic time of the day is a useful lesson. It certainly applies in my case. I'm very much a morning writer. I sort of peter out as the day goes on. When I wake up and have a strong coffee, I'll sometimes go for a dog walk before I get writing. That sort of gets the blood pumping a bit, gets oxygen in the lungs, and then you feel more sort of awake and time to crack on. And then it feels like a very intense time and a sort of creative time to start writing. So this is maybe 6 in the morning. And then, you know, I tend to, I know some people, I had an agent who I remember was saying, gave me the advice of, the advice he sometimes gave to writers, saying, just start writing, just plow on through to the finish, basically. Once you've got your ideas for how you want to structure the book, just keep going until you get the end, and then do all the sort of the fine tuning, the polishing at the draft stages to do it that way. But that just never worked for me. I have to, particularly a sort of opening, a first chapter, or even an opening few paragraphs, I have to keep polishing and polishing and polishing until I'm really sort of happy with the result, just because I then sort of believe in the book more, I think. When it's in a sort of sloppy half-written stage, it sort of feels a bit sort of I lose confidence in it a bit, and so I don't really sort of I'm not sure where it's going or whether it's going to work out properly. Whereas if I've polished and polished and polished and got this opening really sort of pitch perfect, or as perfect as I can at that stage, then it sort of gives me a confidence to carry on with the rest, because I believe that this is something worthwhile and is going to go the course. Because it's a long, tangled process, obviously, writing a novel, and it goes through lots of different versions. But that's for me the crucial bit. And the actual sort of finding your way through the structure, for me, the technique there is I sort of like to do this thing of doing 1 to 30 down an A4 page, just writing the numbers, and then just sort of putting a sort of chapter idea alongside each one. So you've got a natural beginning, middle and end, and you can sort of see a shape. It's, I guess, having a skeleton that you're then going to flesh out. But in terms of the how the day pans out, I think, again, in my case, it's if I've taken a week off work, as in journalism work, to really sort of nail a few chapters of a novel that I'm working for, I tend to really, because it's eating into your sort of holiday time, as it were, I tend not to waste any time. That's the thing. I don't really sort of, I can't really indulge not sort of going off and sort of my mind wandering or whatever. So I'll really sort of put in sort of 9 or 10 hours, solid hours of writing, just to make sure I'm not wasting that time. Because as well, earlier books, having a young family or whatever, it was a big ask of my wife when I'd be having to work on them at weekends and evenings and in my holidays. So it was sort of precious working time that couldn't be wasted.
Are you mainly writing in those, the weeks that you take off as holiday, or like the chap that you referenced earlier, are you pretty good at balancing work life, writing life in the morning with then work life for the times a bit later on?
No, I don't think I have been particularly good at getting that balance. It's funny, I was looking at some family videos I've got three sons, and when they were young, sort of 8, 9, 10, 8, that sort of age, they'd be playing outside, and I was going out filming them, and they were saying, come and play, and I was saying, oh, I've got a deadline or something, I can't, and hearing myself say this on these old family videos, it's like a stab in the heart. It's awful. I think, oh God, why didn't I just play with them? It didn't matter that much. I think there's a lot of, because of most people's circumstances when they're trying to do a book, there's very few people have the sort of there's very few people who can sort of earn a living from it and just do it as a full-time thing. They're combining it with other things usually, and so that you've got to sort of juggle, really. It's finding a sort of a balance and making the most of your spare time, I suppose.
When you start work, as you say, 6-ish in the morning, what makes a good writing day for you? How long will you stick around for? How much do you want to get done?
I just keep going, really. And I suppose, although having said that, you sort of, it's slightly indulgent to wait until you're in the mood. It's definitely the case that sometimes things will flow better, and it might even be just whether you've had a good night's sleep and whether you're just feeling mentally alert and have the right sort of energy levels. I think there is a sort of energy side to writing, and a mood side to an extent. You can't always indulge it, and sometimes you just have to crack on and get something finished. But other times, you do notice it when you're in a a good space. Something I noticed about column writing, actually, when if I had had to write a column and knew I was sort of I would have a certain particular deadline, and I had to go somewhere in a car, if there's a car journey, it might have been a school run or something. And that meant having not being able to take your hands off a steering wheel and make sort of notes. It forced you to sort of think through the structure of the whole column idea in your head. So when you got to the end of the journey and got hold of a laptop, it was almost like downloading it fully formed and very quickly, writing really quickly. So sometimes it's like they always say of essays, student essays, that it's really worthwhile spending that 10 minutes planning time just because you know what you want to write when you actually start writing. And that applies to research as well, I think, because what I tend to, in terms of novels, what I tend to do is historical novels. So I'll often really research the historical period by just soaking up a lot of contemporaneous diaries and letters and history books. So by the time you're actually, because all the while sort of mulling over ideas, but by the time you actually come to it, all the research is sort of swirling around in your head, and you can sort of channel it to an extent. I think that's the key to doing historical stuff. You're already in the atmosphere, and in that respect, sometimes when I've written pieces set in the sort of 20s, 30s, 40s, I've sometimes put on some music from that period just to get me in the atmosphere a bit, Jack Buchanan or Glenn Miller or something. Not music I particularly like, but I find incredibly evocative, especially, oddly enough, that Glenn Miller did some recordings of with German singers, which is, I don't understand what they're saying necessarily, but I just find that it sort of gets you into this sort of different era and a different sort of space. It's like going through a crack in the time-space continuum almost.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We've got more from Nigel in just a sec. Very quickly, just popping up to remind you, if you're loving the show, if you're learning things that can help the way that you tell your stories, I'd love you to send a little our way by means of Patreon. You can do that, patreon.com/writersroutine. Just a tiny amount every month. It goes a really long way. It helps us carry on bringing you these chats every week, as often as we can. Two a week now, with the bonus episode, the random routine that we're bringing you pretty much every Wednesday. For that little bit of cash that you send our way, you get bits of merch, you get more bonus episodes. There is even a way for your book to sponsor this show, and you'll always get our eternal thanks. Seriously, a tiny amount, it goes so far for the show. It means the world. We appreciate everything that we've got so far. And if you'd like to get involved, pledge what you can, patreon.com/writersroutine. Right, let's get back to it then with Nigel Farndale talking about his brand new book, The Dictator's Muse. In this part, we'll talk about how he uses real life people in his fiction, what he makes up and what he leaves in. Also, how being an award-winning interviewer has impacted the way that he tells stories. And we pick things up with one last thing about his writing day. When he sits down, how much does he want to get done by the end?
I ignore the old word count thing. I think it's kind of meaningless in my circumstance. I think I'm much more... And part of this thing when I was talking about polishing before you sort of... So you can start believing in what you're writing and feel more confident about it and think, yeah, this has got the makings of something decent. I think starting your day by rereading something polished really gets you in the right sort of place mentally to push on, and then you'll find the next section or next chapter or whatever just feels more finished maybe.
Now, the new book, The Dictator's Muse, just tell us about the very first moment that the idea came into your head. What was the light bulb that the idea presented itself as?
In a way, it's an example of this. Well, I was talking about the cross-fertilization with journalism and writing books. And I was actually asked to do an interview with Leni Riefenstahl in 2000, when she was 98 at the time, but incredibly sort of with it. At that stage, she'd just recently been involved in a helicopter crash, you can't imagine in that age of 98, and had got out of it. And her first thoughts when she emerged from the wreckage was whether she could reconstruct the moment and get it on film. You know, she's quite a sort of feisty character. Anyway, I couldn't actually do that interview because it clashed with another one I was down to do, which couldn't be more contrasting, really. It was with Ronnie Corbett. So I went ahead and did that. And a colleague of mine, David Jenkins, went off to Germany to interview Leni Riefenstahl. I always kind of regretted missing out on doing that one because I was very interested in her, and I just kept thinking about her work and about her extraordinary life. She was a very controversial, rather ambivalent figure who was loved and loathed in equal measure. And extraordinarily, she was one of the few, in fact, really the only female figure of any sort of influence and power within the Third Reich. She was Hitler's favourite filmmaker, especially after her the documentary she made of the 1934 Nuremberg rally, and which was turned into the film Triumph of the Will. And then also her film on the Olympic Games. And I think possibly it was the frustration of missing out on this chance of having interviewed her that kept me coming back to her in terms of research. And then this idea formed of, as I read her memoirs, I realized that it was full of omissions and half-truths, and she was sort of, she reinvented herself in her memoirs, and they didn't correspond with other people's accounts of what was going on in the Third Reich in the 1930s. And I just got the feeling that she was the sort of the ultimate unreliable narrator, and this sort of started a sort of train of thinking that what if her novel, what if there was a novel to write about the real the truth behind her extraordinary story. I sort of watched the films, and I read the memoirs and read as many biographies of her as I could. And one of the things that came out was that when she died in 2003, at the age of 101, she left behind this incredible archive of 700 boxes full of letters, diaries, and lots of reels of film, because she'd been making films all throughout her life. And they still haven't really been looked at all this time afterwards. And there are plans for an exhibition of them in Germany, but obviously she's still a very controversial figure there. And in fact, the Triumph of the Will is still not allowed to be screened there for obvious reasons. And I just wondered what was on these reels of film. And that was the catalytic moment, in a way, that sparked this whole novel, imagining a film historian being given access to this archive and coming across this particular clip of film, which was of an athlete at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, which Leni Riefenstahl had filmed. And this sort of would be the sort of way into her story, and it was the version of her life that she had been always wanting to tell. So that's where it started, really. In terms of using real life people in fiction, I mean, it sounds like an odd thing to do, doesn't it? I appreciate this, and I haven't really done it before. Although I've written biographies before, and that sort of, but they were quite fictional biographies in a funny sort of way, or at least biographies written in a novelistic style. So this is sort of the other way round. And taking this this real person and sort of trying to imagine her world and get inside her thoughts was very interesting proposition, really. In terms of getting to the heart of the story and getting that list of chapters. To an extent, you can sort of, once you've got to know someone, and she is a sort of fiction, even though she really existed, she is a sort of fictional character in this book. And once I'd sort of really decided on her nature and character, I found when I was putting her in situations, some events had sort of happened, and I was able to. It might be a sort of paragraph of an account of something that happened, like when she was filming one of the Nuremberg rallies. But then expanding that, because you're sort of in her head, and you're going off in taking that as a sort of starting point, and just expanding the scene to fill it out. That was the challenge, and this idea of using his real people in, although it sounds a bit mad in a way, it sort of happens more often than you think. I mean, if you look at some like Wolf Hall, it's one of the ultimate works of fiction, but it's about a real person, and as is when look at The Crown, that's people. I think people found The Crown quite confusing, because it is a work of fiction based on historical events, but all the dialogue, all the situations, all the personalities are from the imagination of Peter Morgan. That's the sort of challenge, I think, of writing historical novels and dramas, that you've got to you've got to sort of have the courage to of your convictions in a funny sort of way. I was thinking there of what was it? Oh, Alan Bennett. He was when he did The Madness of King George, he was quite feeling quite nervous about putting words into the mouths of these historical characters, because he said, "Oh, look, I know these situations happened, but we don't know what they said at the time, obviously, because there was no recordings or anything." And Nicholas Heitner, the director, just said, you've got to just treat it as fiction and just sort of get over yourself in a way. And that was quite a liberating thought. And once you do that, then it becomes a very satisfying writing process, because you're dealing with specific moments in history. You can, as a writer, believe in the authenticity of the situation more, in a way, more than if they were all fictional characters. I mean, she is mixing with some fictional characters, but she herself was a real character, as it were. That's a conceit that I know who was. Robert Harris did that with Munich, one of his recent novels, where he's taking a very big sort of historical moment, which is the Munich peace talks, and interweaving these two central characters were completely fictional, and he sort of put them in that situation, and once you do that, it gives it a sort of a texture. You always start to get this sort of, it's like weaving in very similitude, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
Lastly, you are very well known for your interview prowess. What has asking questions for a living, pretty much, how has that impacted the way that you storytell?
I think that the way that I have written interviews, because they're sort of, you know, these big sort of 3,000 word sort of magazine interviews, I have sort of found it has just helped to sort of structure them as in a novelistic way, I suppose. It's going back to this beginning, middle, and end, and almost treating real people as fictional characters, and sort of, and it's quite liberating. And the trick in terms of interviewing, so when you do write a big interview, you'll do your research, and then you spend usually a day traveling. You might be flying to somewhere to get to the other end, get your tape recorder out. You spend maybe a couple of hours talking to someone, and then you spend several more hours transcribing the tape. But you don't transcribe the whole tape. You're just sort of getting all the good quotes, and you're re-entering the moment of doing the interview, and it gets you back in the room in a way. But also by then you've sort of set up this distance between the actual interview. So it might be several days later, and some of this sort of stardust has disappeared. So you feel more emboldened to not sort of suck up, really, and just be more objective and have some mischief with it sometimes. But in terms of the dialogue, it's actually been, I find it very useful in terms of novel writing, because when you really listen to the way people talk, I mean, you'll have noticed today, a kindness would be to edit out all my pauses and hesitations and repetitions, but actually that's the way people speak. You do hesitate and repeat yourself and stammer and whatever, and use sort of ungrammatical sentences, and to actually really make dialogue seem authentic, you've got to have some of that in there, and trying to make it less stilted and more naturalistic. I think that's been something useful I've got from interviewing, and there has been cross-fertilization.
And that is it for Nigel Farndale. Thanks so much to him for coming on. You can get a copy of his new book, The Dictator's Muse, using the link wherever you're listening. And there's one over at writersroutine.com as well. While you're there, get in touch with the show. Use the contact form. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at writerspod. And if you can, if you do have a spare sec, leave us a review on Apple and make sure you're following us wherever you get your podcasts from. Next week, we're chatting about another historical thriller. The author Alexis Landor is going to be on to tell us about her brand new book set in World War II. It's called Those Who Are Saved. She's on the show next week. In the meantime, if you can, you can always pledge to support us at patreon.com/writersroutine. Until then, I will see you next week with Alexis Landor on the show, talking about those who are saved. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.